Okay, so welcome back. Let us remember, we have two ways to capture shape so far. Namely, one was to specify the metric. Specifying the metric meant specifying infinitesimal distances. Now, clearly, if you specify infinitesimal distances, if you specify the distance between any very close by points, then you have by implication specified all distances, and therefore you've specified the shape of the manifold. Here's a paper that I wrote in that context that you may want to look up. Now, the metric is the first way we used, the first method to use, that we used to describe the shape of a manifold. Then we introduced the affine connection. The affine connection describes the shape of a manifold differently, namely by expressing the curvature in terms of the non-triviality of parallel transport. And this implicitly also defined the shape. But then, how does it define the shape? Today, we will look into the two notions that come closest to our intuition about what shape is. And one of them is torsion, and the other one is curvature. So how do we express torsion and curvature in terms of what we know already, the affine connection? Now, let us remember, for that purpose, a key result that we found for the affine connection. We found that the affine connection, which after all defines parallel transport, the affine connection, these Christoffel symbols, are not tensors. These are not the coefficient functions of a tensor. And we know that because under change of coordinates, if we change the bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces, always in the canonical way, then the coefficient functions change like this. And we have this offending term here, this one. See, if that term was absent, this would be the usual tensorial transformation law. But because of that term, we can conclude that gamma is not a tensor. Affine connection is not a tensor. However, there is something in there that is a tensor. Let's look at this offending term. Remember that this is the term that prevents gamma from being a tensor. Now, that term here has the two indices A and B here. A and B arising here. These are the two lower indices of the Christoffel symbol. And because of the nature of that term being a derivative with respect to d by dxA and d by dxB, we know that that expression is symmetric under exchange of A and B. Which means that this offending term is always a symmetric term, can never be anti-symmetric. Which means that, if we are lucky, the anti-symmetric part of gamma may not have this and may be a tensor. And that's true. The anti-symmetric part of gamma, as we will now see, transforms like a tensor, therefore is a tensor, and it is what is called the torsion tensor. So let's look at this explicitly. Let us decompose the Christoffel symbol, gamma, into a symmetric part with respect to the two lower indices and an antisymmetric part with respect to the two lower indices. So we take the Christoffel symbol and switch around the two indices, add it up, and then take 1/2. That expression is certainly symmetric under the interchange of I and J. This expression with the minus sign is, of course, obviously anti-symmetric with respect to interchanging I and J. And the sum of the two, the sum of the symmetric and anti-symmetric part, is, of course, the original Christoffel symbol that we started with. So we decompose the Christoffel symbol uniquely in this way into its symmetric and anti-symmetric part with respect to the two lower indices. And then what we find is that the transformation law is simply this. That drops out. Why does it drop out? Well, because that's the symmetric term over there. So we have that the anti-symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol is a tensor. It's a one-fold contravariant and two-fold covariant tensor. I mean, these are just the coefficient functions, which are scalar, but they're the coefficient functions of a tensor. Now we define the tensor to be twice that. That has to do with the fact that we took one-halves over there. So the torsion tensor, this is meant to be a capital tau, not a J, it's a capital tau. The torsion tensor, capital tau, with one contravariant and two covariant indices in its coefficient functions, is defined to be twice the anti-symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol. So in other words, the Christoffel symbol consists of an anti-symmetric part, which is tensorial, and the total thing is, of course, not tensorial, so the symmetric part is not tensorial. Now, in general relativity, you will see that we will assume that there is no torsion. In general relativity, we assume that the Christoffel symbol is symmetric, that it doesn't have an anti-symmetric part. The anti-symmetric part is just vanishing everywhere. Now, there's experimental evidence for that, or I should say there is no experimental evidence that would point towards the existence of torsion. We don't have any experimental evidence that would indicate that the gammas have an anti-symmetric component, and therefore we say, well, if experiments don't force us to introduce it, we drop it. We will later also see a fundamental argument for why there shouldn't be torsion, but we still always have to keep in the back of our minds that when classically something is zero, doesn't mean that quantum mechanically it might not fluctuate around it. Like take a harmonic oscillator in its ground state. If it's a classical harmonic oscillator, the location is zero and that's it. But the quantum harmonic oscillator is fluctuating around that. So it could be that in the quantum theory we have at least some quantum fluctuations around zero torsion. Nobody knows whether that's the case or not. So here's an argument for why there shouldn't be torsion that goes beyond just experiment. It's the extended equivalence principle. As we will later see, the Christoffel symbol expresses gravitational as well as pseudo forces. Actual gravitational forces because you're attracted to a mass, but also the pseudo forces that you feel if you're going around on a carousel, right? That will try to drag you out. That's pseudo forces. The gamma contains both. And what we want as the equivalence principle is that we should always be able to go into a free-falling coordinate system. And at the origin of that free-falling coordinate system, we should not have any gravitational effect. There shouldn't be any pseudo forces. There shouldn't be any gravitational forces, like a free-falling elevator or a free-falling spacecraft towards the moon or something. Locally in that spacecraft, you shouldn't feel any pseudo or gravitational forces. And therefore, it is natural to ask that in general relativity, we want this extended equivalence principle to hold, which is to say there ought to be, for every event in space-time, for every location in space-time, there ought to exist a coordinate system, or maybe multiple coordinate systems, but at least one, such that in this coordinate system, at least at the origin of that coordinate system, the gamma, the Christoffel symbol, is vanishing. Okay? So I'm not saying that there should be a coordinate system where the gamma vanishes everywhere. No. But you should be able to choose at any point and then find a coordinate system tailored for that point so that at that point the gamma is zero. Right? Gamma being zero means there is nothing gravitational, not curvature, not torsion. So the extended equivalence principle says no Christoffel symbols should always be possible by choosing the coordinate system appropriately, and we will later find out how to actually calculate that coordinate system that does it. Okay, so the extended equivalence principle, the principle that it should always be possible to make gamma vanish locally by a suitable choice of coordinates around the point P, That principle rules out the existence of torsion. Basically, because if a tensor vanishes in one coordinate system, it must vanish in all coordinate systems. Because remember how tensors transform under changes of coordinates, how the coefficient matrices of tensors transform. They have these Jacobian matrices times the tensor before, right? Tensor before, Jacobian matrices, and then the tensor. Now, if the tensor originally was zero, then whichever way you transform, you get a zero out of that. Okay, so the torsion, okay, let me explain why the extended equivalence principle rules out the existence of torsion. The torsion is a tensor. It transforms linearly with invertible Jacobian matrices. Here is the torsion tensor before change of coordinate. Then here's the torsion tensor after change in coordinates. I mean, explicitly, these are the coefficient functions of the torsion tensor, the scalar coefficient functions. And these are the Jacobian matrices that we get because we have one contravariant index. There is one Jacobian matrix with a bar up here, and then two covariant indices, so we get two Jacobian matrices with the bars down there. And clearly, if in the original unbarred coordinate system the torsion tensor vanishes, then that will vanish too, because that's how this works. That would not have been true for the Christoffel symbol, because it has an additional term that doesn't even depend on the Christoffel symbol, right? Remember that? Okay. All right, now, vice versa. If the torsion tensor is vanishing at all points of the manifold, the torsion tensor vanishes at all points in the manifold, then there is for every point of the manifold a chart where the Christoffel symbol is vanishing. We just saw the other way around. Now let's look at this way around. Okay, so the claim is that if the torsion vanishes, then there is at every point of the manifold a chart where the Christoffel symbol is vanishing. To see why that is true, it's intuitive, but to see why this is true, let us introduce a whole machinery that we will find useful for many occasions later on. First, let us remember what it means that a vector field is autoparallel to a path gamma in the manifold. So we have a path gamma which maps a, within quotation marks, time parameter onto locations in the space-time. That's our path. And if we differentiate these locations with respect to t, we get tangent vectors, according to the geometric definition of what tangent vectors are. So this would be gamma dot. And then we take our vector field, psi, and we differentiate it covariantly in the direction that we are moving. So we travel on this path, and we differentiate as we go along in the direction of gamma dot, which is the tangent. So we are taking a vector field, which may point in any arbitrary direction, and we differentiate it in the direction of travel. And then we say that if the covariant derivative of the vector field vanishes along that path, then we say that psi has been parallel transported along that path, because it's always not changing its direction, right? We always differentiate in the direction of travel, and the rate of change of psi in the direction of travel is zero. So we say psi is a tangent vector field, a contravariant vector field that is being parallel transported along the path that we travel. And so we say that psi is autoparallel to this path. Being autoparallel to the path is the same as saying it's been parallel transported along that path. And then when we spell that out, we did that last time, when we spell this out in the coordinate system, this abstract equation, then we obtain this differential equation for the psi and for the gamma. So what is the gamma dot here? Well, it's dxi by dt, right? Because the coordinates, gamma maps t into coordinates, and you differentiate those coordinates x with respect to t. These are the dxi by dt. This is gamma dot. And then the psi has coefficients psi k. So if we are given a Christoffel symbol, which is to say if we're given a curved manifold, And we are given an initial vector at the initial point of the path we want to travel. Then solving this differential equation along that path, which is to say for larger and larger t, tells us how the coefficients of this tangent vector field evolve if the tangent vector field is being parallel transported along the path. Now, what if we want to parallel transport not some arbitrary vector field, but let us calculate not how some arbitrary vector field changes as we move along the path, but how the tangent vector field, how the tangent vector changes. So we are traveling in some direction, and we take our arm and we point in the direction of travel, and then we differentiate that pointing vector in the direction of travel. That's here. We take the direction of travel vector as a function of t as we travel along, and we covariantly differentiate that in the direction of travel. And then we say, if that's zero, then we are not changing direction. We keep our hands off the steering wheel. We are really going geodesic, right? This is what a geodesic means. We're going autoparallel, which is to say that the direction of travel is parallel transported. So we say that a curve is a geodesic curve if its tangent vector at any point of travel is autoparallel along the path that we travel. So if the velocity is parallel transported along the path of travel. So the tangent vectors to the path are parallel translates of each other. Now that means that our autoparallel equation from above becomes this equation. Well, how do I go back on this? Well, I hope you remember that. We had the autoparallel equation, which was first order in time. And now, the field that we parallel transport is no longer the field psi. The field that we parallel transport is dx by dt. So wherever there used to be psi coefficients, like here used to be psi dot, dxi by dt, right? And now we have dx by dt squared, because the psi is already the first derivative. And then, same over there. There used to be xi over there. But now we're parallel transporting the tangent vector itself. And this condition, the geodesic equation, is expressing in coordinates what abstractly means that we are that the curve is such that the tangent vector is parallel transported. All the tangent vectors to the curves are parallel translates of each other. Now, we can also view this simply as a matter of an ordinary differential equation and apply the theory of ordinary differential equations, and it guarantees that if this coefficient function is sufficiently smooth, then we're going to have a solution to this. We fix initial conditions, and it's second order, so we fix the position and the velocity, and then the differential equation dictates how the geodesic proceeds from there, at least some finite distance. We might run into singularity eventually, and we will cover that later in the course. This is a method to detect singularities in the space-time. But for now, let's just take away from the theory of ordinary differential equations that we can always give ourselves initial conditions, a position and a velocity, like an x mu and a dx mu by dt. And then this equation tells us how the path continues. Now, let us look at the geodesic equation from the point of view of scaling. Imagine we rescale the time parameter. Instead of t, we now use a time parameter t prime, which is 5 times t, just for the heck of it. Why not? It's not the actual time anyway. It's just some parameter that we pulled out of the hat, right? So it's some parameter. And instead of using the old parameter t, now we use t prime, which is 5 times t. it turns out we still get a solution. The same path is still a solution, and we can easily see that because we get here 25 and there 25. Right? It just drops out by the chain rule, right? D by dt, dt by dt prime, dt by dt prime is just 5, right? Because we just defined the two time parameters to be linearly related. So when we rescale, we get still a solution. Now, okay, so as I said, we have a differential equation of second order. So by specifying some point as the initial point of the geodesic, gamma naught, gamma of time parameter 0, and we specify an initial velocity vector, gamma dot, an initial tangent vector to the geodesic, well, then we plug that in here and we get the solution for finite times. And now the scaling behavior that we observed means the following. It means that if we take a geodesic and we label it by being a function of time, but it also is a function of the initial velocity. And let's just say we always start at the same point. We start the geodesic always at the same point. Otherwise, I would also have to write here which point we start the geodesic in. Let's just say it's always starting at the same point, P. Then every geodesic is labeled by two parameters, the initial velocity and the amount of time that we run along the geodesic. And then that gives us the point in the manifold, right? For every xi and t, we get a point in the manifold. If we choose t equal to 0, it's just the starting point. If xi we choose to be 0, well, then the geodesic never travels, right? So then we just stay at the same point. Anyway, the scaling law that we saw there, the trivial scaling behavior that we saw there, means that if we have a solution to the geodesic equation, well, then if we put a factor here, like 5 that we did earlier, a factor of 5 here, then that also solves the geodesic equation. And for any real number lambda, we have that, again, because of the linearity here of the scaling, we have that we can actually move this number 5 from multiplying the time parameter over here to multiplying the initial condition. Okay? So it means that whether we run the time 5 times as fast, or we run the time the same speed as before, but we start with an initial condition, initial velocity that's 5 times higher, then we get the same thing, right? So it doesn't matter whether we rescale the time variable so that we run through this curve 5 times faster, or we leave the time variable the same, but we start with an initial velocity that's 5 times higher. We get the same curve out of it. That's what this here says. So you can put a factor from here also there. Here it's multiplying the initial condition vector, the initial velocity vector. There it's just the scaling of the time. Okay. All pretty straightforward stuff. Now we can define the so-called exponential map. This is a vast generalization of something that you know from quantum mechanics. Namely, or actually from Taylor expansion. If you have e to the power of a d by dx and apply that to a function f of x, then what's that? Assuming that the function is analytic. View this as a series. Okay? 1 plus a d by dx plus 1 half a squared d by dx squared, etc. You recognize what that is? It's a Taylor series. Right? We get higher and higher derivatives of f multiplied with higher and higher powers of a. This is f of x plus a. In other words, this is the translation operator. You may have heard in quantum theory that the momentum operator is a translation operator. In quantum theory, e to the power of I a p hat applied to psi of x is psi of x plus a. Okay? Because this thing has a minus I d by dx in it, and the minus I multiplies that I gives us the plus, and then it's exactly this thing, which is Taylor expansion. In this sense, momentum generates translations. You may have seen a similar thing, e to the power of I alpha L hat 3 applied to psi of x gives us psi of a rotated coordinate system, depending on whether you view it actively or passively, but this will rotate everything by the angle alpha about the z-axis. Okay? If you're not familiar with this and are interested in this, send me an email. I will send you my lecture notes on quantum mechanics, and you can read up on that stuff. Super important. More generally, exponentiating the generators of a Lie algebra will give you elements of a Lie group. Exponentiation is what gets you from infinitesimal to finite. All of that is still flat. Now we do this on curved space. We do the analog of the exponential map for curved space, but without the group theory. Okay, so consider a fixed point of the manifold P. Then the so-called exponential map around the point P is a translation operator, just like this guy is, right? This one, right, or that. By dx, translation operator. Remember, these guys are tangent vectors, right? D by dx, by dxi. Anyway, so the exponential map does the following job. It takes a tangent vector, which you can think of as an initial velocity vector for your geodesic, right? You have a soccer ball and you kick it. Then you get to choose the direction and the force with which you kick it. And that's the vector that is a contravariant vector here, right? So the exponential map takes your kicking vector and maps it into a point in the manifold. How? The exponential map says, give me the vector that describes the velocity with which you kick the ball. And then the exponential map is where the ball is 1 second in. So you take the parameter of the geodesic, and you run it through using the geodesic differential equation. You run it until the parameter of the geodesic reaches the value 1. It's like kicking the soccer ball and then waiting for 1 second and checking where it is. Clearly, for any initial kick vector, you get some location of the ball after a second. And this is what the exponential map does. It's basically choosing the A to be 1. Or, actually, we have several of these, several different directions, and then these coefficients are the coefficients of the kick vector. Okay, so the exponential map takes a tangent vector and outputs a location, a point on the manifold. Namely, the point where the geodesic is at the time equals 0. So we consider the geodesic gamma, which has the property that it starts at the central point P that we are interested in, the point P about which the exponential map is defined. So we take a geodesic that starts at point P with initial velocity vector, gamma dot xi of 0 is equal to xi, right? So the initial velocity, the velocity at time 0, is supposed to be this xi. Where does xi live? In what vector space does it live? It's a tangent vector at the point P. Okay? So we pick a point in the manifold P, and we pick a tangent vector in the tangent space to the point P, because we are setting initial conditions. We choose a location, P, and we choose a velocity, xi. And the location P is a point in the manifold. The velocity xi is a tangent vector in the tangent space to the point P. Okay, and then we run the differential equation, the geodesic equation, until the parameter reaches the value 1. And then we read off where we are. Where is the geodesic after time 1? That's the point where we end up with. That is the output of the exponential map. It gives us a location. So from what we had earlier, from the scaling law, equation G that we had above, we have that if we run a geodesic with initial velocity vector xi for time lambda, then this is the same as if we pulled this lambda here in front and started with a higher velocity, or a velocity multiplied by lambda, and run the geodesic until the value 1. But this, by definition, is the exponential map. Right? The exponential map is, take the initial velocity vector, here is lambda xi, and then run the geodesic until the value 1 is reached. Okay, so we have that the exponential map can be viewed as these two expressions here. So from where to where does the exponential map map? Well, it takes as its input tangent vectors to the point P. They live in a vector space. A vector space is a manifold. It's a very simple one. Rn is a very simple flat manifold, but it's a manifold. So the exponential map takes as its input vectors from the tangent space. And as its output, it gives us points on the manifold. So overall, it's a map from manifold to manifold. It's a map from the manifold given by the tangent space to the point P into the actual manifold, the space-time manifold. And it's a diffeomorphism. So the exponential map is a diffeomorphism from a neighborhood, at least, or even all of it, from a neighborhood of the point, from a neighborhood of the zero vector in the tangent space to the point P. And of course, the tangent space is isomorphic to Rn. All tangent spaces are isomorphic to Rn if the dimension of the manifold is n. And the exponential map maps that neighborhood of the origin into some point of the manifold, P in M. Now, why can we not say that the exponential map maps all of the tangent space into the manifold? Well, it's because the differential equation may run into some singularity. It may run into a point where you cannot further extend the geodesic. So it could be that your tangent vector that you start with, that your initial velocity vector, is too big. It could be that you kick the football so hard that within 1 second, it actually manages to travel so far that it hits the singularity along the way. Right? So just to be careful, we say, all right, the exponential map may not be defined on the entire tangent space, just some neighborhood around zero. If you don't kick the ball too hard, then you always get a well-defined location for where it is. Another difficulty with the exponential map is that in a curved space-time, it could happen that if you kick the soccer ball this way and follow it for a second and then nail down where it is, and then alternatively you kick it in that way and you nail down where it is after a second, it might be the same point, right? Because it follows the geodesic along the curvature that way and then another curvature this way, and the two geodesics might meet again. Okay? We have to keep that in mind. This is not necessarily an invertible map, exponential map. But for our coordinate systems, we want that. We want that it's invertible. All right, so what we have is that at least in some neighborhood of the origin, we neither run into singularities, nor do we run into these ambiguities that we could have arrived at the same point on two different geodesics. So in a sufficiently small neighborhood, we have that the exponential map actually provides a chart, because it's an invertible diffeomorphism from the tangent space to the manifold. Okay. Small tangent vectors, small kicking velocity vectors, are mapped into points on the manifold. And for every kicking velocity vector xi, we get that point in the manifold where the geodesic that started with that velocity ends up after time equal 1. Okay, so that means we have now a very special kind of coordinate system. Let us choose a basis in the tangent space to the point P. So let's say E1, E2, up to EN are basis vectors in the tangent space to the point P. This could be the d by dx1, d by dx2, but there's no reason to choose them. This could be any basis vectors in our tangent space. Then any tangent vector, and therefore any initial kicking velocity vector, is a linear combination of these guys with coefficients xi I. Then, whenever we choose coefficients xi I, we've chosen a tangent vector, and we can feed it into the exponential map, and we get a point of the manifold. Therefore, any choice of coefficients here, we get a point of the manifold. So we have a coordinate system that associates a bunch of numbers to points in the manifold. So through the exponential map at the point P, these coefficients xi I, the velocity coefficients with respect to these bases, these coefficients xi I become the coordinates of points in the neighborhood of P, the point P in the manifold. So through the exponential map, we naturally obtain a coordinate system. In fact, many coordinate systems, any basis we choose will give us a coordinate system. So it works this way, that we choose these coefficients. That means we choose a tangent vector, but that's then used in the exponential map. It's used as the initial velocity vector. Then we evolve the geodesic equation until the parameter reaches 1, and we get a point in the manifold. That's the point M. So all of these coefficients, these initial velocity coefficients, are used to identify a point in the manifold. We have a coordinate system. It's not going to be global in general because of the ambiguity and because of the possibility of singularities. Now, these coordinates, these xi I, are called normal coordinates or geodesic coordinates or Riemann normal coordinates. They're going to be super important because they are basically the coordinates that an observer would use in a freely falling elevator or freely falling spacecraft. Let's see. We can conclude now that the geodesics gamma, which run through a point P, are actually straight lines if we use a Riemann normal coordinate system. Okay, so let me repeat this. If we use a Riemann normal coordinate system obtained in this way around a point P, then any geodesic that runs through that point P will be a straight line in such a coordinate system. Recall why that is. We have that the exponential map of this initial vector here, initial velocity vector, is what we obtain when we take the geodesic and we run it all the way to the value one, to the value lambda. Right? Because remember that by the linearity of the geodesic equation, we can pull this lambda over here. Right? And then we just have a one there, and that explains why we have here the geodesic, why we have here the exponential map. But we don't have to have the lambda here, we can put it there. And then we have this equation, which tells us that as we increase the value of lambda, this expression takes us along the path, right? Because this is the time parameter along the path, along the geodesic. But as we increase lambda, we see on this side that all we do is that in the tangent space, we take the tangent vector xi of the initial velocity and multiply it with lambda. So this means that moving a straight line in the tangent vector space, namely taking an initial vector and multiplying with lambda, right? So we're just making this vector longer and longer. So we're going a straight line in the tangent vector space. In other words, we're going a straight line in the Riemann normal coordinate system. This straight line means we're going along the geodesic around through the point P. Okay. So this is the reason why we have the following picture. The Riemann normal coordinates obtained through the geodesic map can be viewed this way. Here we have the manifold, here's a point P. Through this point P, there are geodesics. This is a geodesic that doesn't run through the point P. All these are geodesics that run through the point P. And I drew them in this curved way, but you should just think of it as arbitrary. Now, a Riemann normal coordinate system means that any point in the neighborhood of zero in the tangent space to this point, so TP, this square thing here, is symbolizing the tangent vector space at this point P. And then every point in here through the geodesic map means a point in the manifold. So this is literally the chart for this map. Every point in this Rn is mapped into a point on the manifold. That's what the chart does, this or the other way around. And now what we have is that if you draw a straight line through the origin here, the origin being the point whose image is P over there, if you draw a straight line, that straight line, by this equation, is mapped into a geodesic. Every geodesic is the image of a straight line through the origin. However, this line doesn't go through the origin. Therefore, we can't make this argument from the exponential map, because the exponential map always assumes that the initial condition is post at the origin. So this geodesic is going to be curved also here. It's only the geodesics that run through the origin that are straight lines in Riemann normal coordinates. And you can probably see already what this means. You see, straight lines means no forces acted on them, which means that there's no pseudo-forces or gravitational forces there. Okay, so in geodesic coordinates, which is to say in Riemann normal coordinates or in normal coordinates, geodesics through a point P are straight lines of constant velocity psi. Because as we run with our time parameter, we are running through the tangent space at a constant velocity. So does this mean that the Christoffel symbol is zero at the origin? Does it mean that? See, intuitively we said yeah, because it's straight lines, right? But does it mean that the Christoffel symbols are vanishing? It doesn't mean that, actually. Let us look at the geodesic equation at the point P. Remember, this is the generic geodesic equation here. But I crossed out that term. How come I could cross out that term? Well, it's because, as we just established, the velocity with which we travel in the Riemann normal coordinate system is constant. So therefore, the acceleration goes away. So this is now the equation for the geodesic equation that's obeyed at the origin. So in the Riemann normal coordinate system, in a geodesic coordinate system, at the origin, this equation holds. See, this is gamma at P. This equation holds. But does that mean that the Christoffel symbol itself has to vanish? It doesn't mean that. Because the Christoffel symbol, if we decompose it into its symmetric and anti-symmetric parts, has the property that the anti-symmetric part, contracted with these two factors, is zero anyway. See, if this is anti-symmetric, and we contract it with these two factors that are symmetric, then that's zero anyway. Which means that this condition is only a condition on the symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol, not on the anti-symmetric part. So if the torsion vanishes, which is to say if the anti-symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol, which is one half of the torsion tensor, if that vanishes, Right? If this thing is vanishing for other reasons, like we axiomatize that and say we just assume in nature this is vanishing, if that is so, then we can say that for each point in the manifold, there exists a chart, there exists a coordinate system, namely Riemann normal coordinate systems, for which the entire set of gravitational and pseudo forces vanishes. Then we can conclude that the Christoffel symbol vanishes. Right? So if torsion vanishes, then yes, this is not there. And the only thing that could be there is the symmetric part, but the symmetric part is vanishing because of the nature of the Riemann normal coordinate system. So just to summarize what that means, it means that if we impose the weak, if we impose the extended equivalence principle, namely that there ought to be, for every point, there ought to exist coordinate systems in which the gamma vanishes, and therefore any gravitational or pseudo force effects vanish. If we require that there exists a free fall in that sense, that there are absolutely no pseudo forces, absolutely no gravitational forces, well, then we have to require that the torsion vanishes, because the torsion would survive choosing Riemann normal coordinates. Even in Riemann normal coordinates, the torsion would still be there. The Christoffel symbol's anti-symmetric part cannot be gotten rid of by choosing coordinates suitably. Of course, we know from prior considerations why it had to be this way, because the anti-symmetric part is a tensor. If it vanishes in one coordinate system, it vanishes in all coordinate systems. Okay, so now, however, what would torsion mean if it existed? What is this thing, geometrically speaking? We all have some intuition for what curvature might be, but what is torsion? And this is important, as I said earlier, because we can't really rule out that nature explores torsion. There may be reasons for why nature makes torsion, for example, energetically, super expensive. Like, it's super hard to produce Higgs particles. They require a lot of energy, so we don't usually see them around. So similarly, it could be that torsion is somehow energetically penalized. There might be some reason that torsion is energetically too expensive, so we don't see it around. But there ought to be, in this case, always fluctuations around that. So what if there is some torsion, even if it's just because of quantum fluctuations? Then what does it do? So far, we know torsion only as the anti-symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol. What does it really do? Okay, let's start over with torsion. Here's an abstract definition of the torsion. Assume that psi 1 and psi 2 are tangent vectors to a point in the manifold. Then we define a torsion map, which takes these two tangent vectors and maps them into another tangent vector. Let's first get the math out of the way, and then I explain what the physics of it is. Okay, so we define a so-called torsion map with a capital tau. And how does it do it? Well, it maps the two input tangent vectors into an output tangent vector, this one, defined to be the covariant derivative of psi 2 in the direction of psi 1 minus the other way around minus the commutator of psi 1 and psi 2. In other words, it's the commutator of the covariant derivatives minus the commutator of the ordinary derivatives. Now, this is a map. It takes two tangent vectors in and outputs a tangent vector. Any such map can also be viewed as a tensor. This is a general principle, namely that covariantly defined maps can always be viewed as tensors, and in fact, tensors can always be viewed as maps as well. It's in a trivial way, it's nothing deep. You see, any map, any linear map, that takes in two tangent vectors and outputs a tangent vector can be viewed as a tensor that has two covariant slots and one contravariant one. Because such an object takes in, obviously, two tangent vectors. If you feed it two tangent vectors, they will contract with the two covariant parts into numbers. And what remains then is a tangent vector. Right? So any 1-2 tensor can be viewed as a map that takes in, just like this, two tangent vectors that annihilate this thing, and then we are left with a tangent vector. If we wanted to, we could also view this as a map in a different way. We could say it takes as input one cotangent vector that annihilates this, and then outputs two covariant vectors. Two cotangent vectors, we could do that too. Or not really two cotangent vectors, it would output a tensor that's twofold covariant. It doesn't have to be the tensor product of two. It could be anything in this vector space of twofold covariant tensors. Just like in quantum mechanics, where the tensor product between two Hilbert spaces consists not just of vectors of one, tensor vectors of the other. It consists of the linear combination of these guys. That's super important because that gives us entanglement. Right? If you have A tensor B plus C tensor D, that's an entangled state. And similarly in quantum in general relativity, a tensor of rank 2, covariant tensor of rank 2, is not necessarily cotangent vector tensor cotangent vector. It's the sum of cotangent vector plus cotangent vector plus cotangent vector tensor cotangent vector, etc. So there's a geometric equivalent to entanglement. It is, of course, not quantum mechanical entanglement. It's just trivially a feature of the tensor product of Hilbert spaces or vector spaces. All right, so we view the torsion map, which is defined in this way, as the commutator of the covariant derivatives minus the commutator of the ordinary derivatives. We use that and say, OK, we can also view this as a tensor, and then it's this tensor. How do we define that? Well, if we satisfy all the open slots of this tensor, so we give it two tangent vectors to feed these two covariant slots and one cotangent vector to annihilate with this contravariant slot. So we feed our tensor two tangent vectors for here and one cotangent vector for there. Then the output is a number, which we want to be the number that we get when we take the torsion map, which takes two tangent vectors as input, namely these two, outputs a tangent vector, and then we evaluate that against the covector here, this one that annihilates that. All right. We will later do this over and over again. So please do let me know if that wasn't clear. That you can take your maps and view them as tensors, and you can view tensors as maps. Now, let's compare that with a prior definition. We already defined what the torsion is, so this new definition better coincide with it, otherwise we are in trouble. So let's see. Let us choose a canonical set of bases. So we choose for xi 1, for the one tangent vector, we choose d by dxi, and for xi 2, we choose d by dxj, and then for omega, the dxk. Then, what is tau kij? Well, as we saw from the previous equation, I don't know how to get to the previous page, though. I don't know how to go forward on this thing. Is it this one, perhaps? No. Oh, good job. Ah, yes, there it is. OK, so. No. Oh. Is this? This is crazy. Ah, oh, it goes in the wrong direction. Okay, there we go. Right, so we have the the torsion tensor, and we feed it these three things, two contravariant, one covariant vectors, and we choose them to be basis vectors to keep things simple. Okay, so we choose them to be basis vectors, and here they are. And we plug them in here, and we get these coefficients. Namely, we have dxk, and then here we have the torsion map applied to these two tangent vectors, which gives us as an output some tangent vector. See, this is the tangent vector, which is the output of the torsion map. And then that's to be evaluated against this cotangent vector. Let's see, now we plug in the definition of the torsion map. Remember, the torsion map was the commutator of the covariant derivatives minus the commutator of the ordinary derivatives. Here's the commutator of the ordinary derivatives. We know that's zero. Okay, d by dx1, d by dx2 is the same as d by dx2, d by dx1. That term goes away. Nice. And here we have the commutator of the covariant derivatives, which we have to work out now. But that's not too hard. We know how that works because this is going to be a Christoffel symbol, and that's going to be a Christoffel symbol. That's just, remember, that's how we define the Christoffel symbols. Christoffel symbols tell us what the covariant derivative of one basis vector is in the direction of another basis vector. So, the covariant derivative of this basis vector in the direction of that basis vector is Christoffel symbol times the basis vectors, and here similarly, and we have to evaluate that against this dual vector here. These are just coefficient functions, we can pull them out, and then we have just Kronecker deltas from evaluating this dual basis against that basis. So we get Christoffel, Kronecker delta, Christoffel, Kronecker delta. We sum over the R so that this becomes K in each case. And here we go. We obtain that the coefficients of the torsion tensor are the antisymmetric part of the Christoffel symbol, which is how we defined it earlier. But then we haven't really explained yet what torsion is. We just have another definition for it now, more abstract definition that doesn't refer to any choices of bases. Now let's see what it means physically. Let me give you the intuition first. Imagine you have a crystal, a perfect crystal of metal or something. So you have lots of planes, parallel planes of nicely, let's say, squarely arranged atoms. And then you go ahead and you bend this thing. You give it some curvature. You twist it somehow, well, without breaking it. Let's assume it's not so brittle. So you bend it a bit. That's the analog of giving it curvature. But what, you see, for example, you would have that parallel transport becomes non-trivial, that the sum of the angles in a triangle wouldn't be pi half and things like that. But now imagine a crystal where, just like in a parking garage, where you can drive a while and then you think you come back, but you're actually one level higher now. Or maybe you're one level lower. Because somehow, well, you always stayed on a plane somehow, but it had a slope. And so similar, you can have in a crystal these shifts in there where you go around a parallelogram, but then you arrive back to where you thought you were, but you're not in the same layer. You're one or several layers different from where you started. And that doesn't require discreteness. In fact, if in a discrete case of a crystal, it's a bit, you know, you need these defects and stuff. But in a continuum, you can have this effect, and that's torsion. And torsion is technically, as we will now see, the fact that it could be in space-time that if you try to walk a parallelogram, let's say by walking from P to Q, in the direction psi, and then in the direction eta, then you arrive at a different point from having tried to walk the opposite way, first in the direction of eta, and then in the direction of psi. So parallelograms would not close. But let's be completely clear about what the instructions here are. So we have two vectors that define our parallelogram, the vector xi and the vector eta. Both are tangent vectors to the point P. So we start at the point P, and then we say, we are going on a trip. And we go first, we choose two velocity vectors, eta and or direction vectors, eta and xi, and we say, I first walk along xi for a unit of time, a small unit of time. I walk along xi while parallel transporting my vector eta in my pocket along the way. And then when I arrive at the endpoint q here, as far as I wanted to walk in the direction xi, then I pull out my vector eta, I check in which direction it points, and then I walk in the direction of eta, which is now, to be fair, eta tilde, because it lives now in a tangent space to this point. It has been parallel transported over there. And then I put a flag into that point in space-time, and I say, this is where I arrive. And then your friend, who started with the same two tangent vectors, xi and eta, to this point here, may say, I go there a different way. That friend is going first in the direction of eta, while she's carrying xi parallel transported in her pocket. And when she arrives at r, she will pull out xi and say, now I walk in the direction of xi. To be fair, it's xi tilde now. It's the parallel transported version of xi over here, living in that tangent space. And then she walks that way. And she plants a flag there too. And then you check, are the two flags at the same point or not? All evidence, experimental evidence, points to the theory that it is going to be the same point. But mathematically, it would be perfectly acceptable to have torsion, to have an endosymmetric part in the Christoffel symbol, and then the parallelograms wouldn't close. Okay, so let's calculate that. Let us remember parallel transport. Parallel transport equation, or the orthoparallel equation, says that a vector field is parallel transported along a path gamma if the covariant derivative in the direction of the tangent to the path is vanishing, which is this equation. So we parallel transport nu along the path given by x of t. All right, so what we need to do is first calculate, let's say your friend walks from P to R in the direction of eta, carrying xi in her pocket, parallel transporting it. We want to know, how does it arrive? What are the coordinates of xi, namely then xi tilde, over at that point? We can calculate that by running the orthoparallel equation, because that tells us how to parallel transport a vector nu, in particular, how to parallel transport a vector xi. What is it going to be? This is a Taylor expansion. So we do xi tilde, the coordinates of that vector that she pulls out of her pocket over there. That vector lives in the point x plus eta I, right? Because we traveled this far. It lives, this tangent vector lives in that tangent space over there. And it is approximately, of course, the same. It has approximately the same coordinates as the coordinates that we started out with, except, well, first derivative change. We are working first order distance here. There should be an epsilon here to be accurate, just to make sure that it's a small quantity. But then I put an approximate sign here, the dx by dt. Now, this is the by Taylor expansion, the small change in the coordinates of xi that her vector xi suffered while being parallel transported there. And what is this change of these coordinates? Well, here we go. Parallel transport equation tells us what the change of the coordinates of any vector are when parallel transported along that path. So we just have to say, OK, the nu is xi now. It's xi that we are parallel transporting. So we can, instead of writing d xi by dt, this one, we write minus gamma this, because this is equal to minus that, right? So we get a minus Christoffel symbol and then that stuff. And the eta comes in because eta is dx by dt. Eta is the direction in which she walked, right? Eta is the direction in which she walked. That's the dx by dt. That's the velocity vector of your travel from, of her travel from here to there. All right. So this is the change of coordinates of our vector psi once she arrives there. And once she has that, she can calculate where she arrives. You see, she started out over here at coordinates x. Then she walked eta. So her coordinates were changed by adding eta. And then her coordinates were further changed by adding psi tilde. So if it was flat space, her coordinates, the place where she puts the flag in the ground, is this coordinates u are given by the original coordinates where she started, plus eta, the first leg of her travel. Then she pulls out the parallel transported psi, but the parallel transported psi is the psi minus this. So this is now added to her coordinates. So it's added the psi minus this. On flat space, that would not be there, and she simply would have started here, traveled this much, traveled that much, it did. But because this is on a generic curved and torsion-full space, that's what we get. And then you come along and say, wait, I do the trip too, but I go first this way and then that way. Obviously, the exact same calculation, except now the roles of psi and eta change. So you're going to get exactly the same expression, just that psi and eta's role will change, which means the indices the other way around. Instead of eta contracting with this, the eta is contracting with that. The only change. Which means that the distance from u to u bar is given by the difference between the Christoffel symbols here with ij and the Christoffel symbol with ji. So we get the anti-symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol here. Right? So analogously, we obtain the result when you travel, not your friend. She gets this with the opposite order of the I and J, or the opposite order of the psi and eta. And then the difference between the two coordinates, where the two flags are in the ground, that's the coordinate distance. And it is given by the torsion tensor contracted with the two vectors that define the parallelogram. So what this is saying is that the torsion tensor has an immediate direct interpretation. The two lower indices are to be contracted with the two vectors that define your parallelogram. Okay? So you do a parallelogram in this direction, eta and psi. You parallel transport in your pockets, as we discussed. You contract that with your torsion tensor. And then you're left, after that contraction, you're still left with the tangent vector's coefficient, because there's just one index up left, right? It's tangent vector. That tangent vector gives you the distance between the two endpoints, between the two flags. Okay, so torsion tells you exactly, if in the parking garage you go this parallelogram, how far away you are from where you started before you did this loop in the parking garage. Okay. Right. Then here's a comment. So what we did, a Taylor expansion where we said that the psi tilde, the tangent vector that she parallel transported on the first leg of her trip, is given by the original tangent vector's coefficients plus the first order change. And then the first order change was expressed in terms of the Christoffel symbol. And now we can do a little manipulation in this. Namely, we can add and subtract something. Very innocent. So we go from here to there by carrying forward that term, carrying forward this term. Notice there's a minus sign, so it's really the same term. And then we add this and we subtract it. Okay, so we haven't really done any harm. But why would we want to do that? Well, if we do this, we notice that this expression is the covariant derivative. It's the thing with the semicolon that we introduced previous lecture. So this is the covariant derivative here, and this is the ordinary derivative term, right? This one. So we can now write that the parallel transported vector is given by having these old coefficients and then minus this thing with the covariant derivative, that's the semicolon here, and here we have it with an ordinary derivative, just an ordinary comma. But that means that if we now calculate again the distance between the two flagpoles that you and your friend planted in the space-time, then we get this expression minus that expression, simply by doing the exact same thing as before, right? It's the same difference that would have been up here if the screen was bigger. And we see that all of this stuff is canceling, of course, and then we are just left with these two terms. And these two terms then combine into the commutator of the covariant derivatives, right? This is with a minus and here's a plus, and the commutator of the ordinary derivatives, right? And this is the torsion tensor. Because remember, when we first defined the torsion map or the torsion tensor, we defined it as the difference between the commutator of the covariant derivatives and the commutator of the ordinary derivatives. And now with this little trick, we see that, yes, we can rephrase it in that form. Right? So the torsion map maps two tangent vectors, namely the ones that define your parallelogram, into a tangent vector. And that tangent vector is obtained as the commutator of the covariant derivatives minus the commutator of the ordinary derivatives. That's exactly what we see here. Okay. Now, that's torsion. How about curvature? What is curvature? Curvature is actually a little more complicated than torsion, which is all the more interesting because why would nature not do something simpler, like torsion? But it definitely does curvature. It seems not to do torsion. Similar procedure to before, we start with the curvature map, and then we define a curvature tensor, and then we check out what is the analog of what used to be, for the torsion, the parking garage argument. You travel a parallelogram, but hey, you ended up in a different level, the parking garage. So we start with the curvature map, curvature tensor, and then the geometry of it. So assume that Xi1, Xi2, Xi3 are tangent vectors to a point, then the curvature map is defined as a map that takes these three tangent vectors and maps them into this expression here, defined in this way. So this is, again, a commutator of covariant derivatives, some sort of commutator of covariant derivatives, except that it's two covariant derivatives, minus the covariant derivative of the commutator, and then applied to Xi3. All of this stuff is a tangent vector at the end. You see, we take a tangent vector, Xi3, and then we covariantly differentiate it, get a tangent vector. Covariantly differentiate it, get a tangent vector. Here, again, we covariantly differentiate in the direction of this tangent vector. So we always covariantly differentiate in tangent vectors with respect to tangent vectors, so the whole thing is a tangent. Now, this thing takes three tangent vectors as input and gives us one tangent vector as output, as a map. But we can also view it as a tensor, the Riemann curvature tensor. As such, it is a tensor in this tensor space here. It is threefold covariant and onefold contravariant. Because these guys can be viewed as a map in the following way. You can feed them three tangent vectors to fill the three covariant slots. And after you've done that contraction, you're left with a tangent vector. Okay? So, the Riemann curvature tensor is a one-fold contravariant and three-fold covariant tensor. And we make the connection between the map and the tensor, again, as before. We take this tensor and fill all of its available slots. So we feed it three tangent vectors and one cotangent vector, three tangent vectors and one cotangent vector. Then this should evaluate to the same number at every point for all of these inputs as taking the Riemann curvature map, feeding it with the three tangent vectors, getting a tangent vector, and then evaluating that against this cotangent vector here, which is also giving us a number, right? But it's just the identification of maps and tensors, of linear maps and tensors. course, tensors can only be interpreted as linear maps. All right. So how does the Riemann curvature tensor look like in a chart? Let's figure that one out first before we look at the geometry of it. So in a chart, it looks like this. Let's say we choose the canonical basis in the tangent and cotangent spaces that come with the coordinate system. Later, of course, we will free ourselves from that constraint. But for now, let's see what we get from our general abstract definition if we choose for our vector and covector fields basis vectors, these basis vectors. Well, then these are the coefficient functions for our Riemann curvature tensor. And explicitly, they are as follows. This thing goes to the right, and then remember that the Riemann curvature map does the commutator of covariant derivatives minus the covariant derivative in the direction of the commutator. Now, the commutator is vanishing, so nicely this term goes away. And here we have the commutator of covariant derivatives. Well, let's carry out one after the other. For example, this covariant derivative acting on that basis vector gives us what? Well, a Christoffel symbol, right? Because that's what Christoffel symbols do. They tell us what the covariant derivative of one such basis vector is with respect to the direction of another basis vector. So what we get is that this covariant derivative now acts on Christoffel symbol and basis vectors, because this expression is that expression. Right? And similarly, this one acting on that is this. And then we still have that to carry forward. Now we need to do the covariant derivative of that expression. What is this? These are coefficient functions, scalar functions. Okay? Coefficient functions are always scalar functions. Remember that. They may have upper, lower indices, whatever. They're always scalar functions. The tensors, the basis vectors, are always these guys. So these are scalar functions multiplying here basis vectors. Covariant derivative of this thing is obtained by the product rule. Covariant derivative of scalar functions is the ordinary derivative of the scalar function. So we get that term plus a term where we leave that alone, and we have the covariant derivative of this on that, which gives us another Christoffel symbol. So we get two terms. We get one term where this is being differentiated. So we get a term where we have a derivative of the Christoffel symbol. We also get a term where we have that the Christoffel symbol is not differentiated, but instead we have that this applied to that generates another Christoffel symbol. So therefore, we get here the term with the derivative of the Christoffel symbol and two Christoffel symbols, right? This one and another were generated by acting with this on that. And similarly, over here. So we get four terms. And here they are. Here are these four terms. We get derivatives of the Christoffel symbol, and we get squared terms of the Christoffel symbol. Now, we could have foreseen that the curvature tensor couldn't just be this, because we know that at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, and we can always, everywhere, choose a Riemann normal coordinate system for every point that we may want, can have one, these Christoffel symbols vanish. So the curvature would vanish. Right? But if the curvature tensor is a tensor, and we define it by construction to be a tensor, then it would vanish everywhere in every coordinate system. These are the guys that survive. So we know now that if you want to calculate the Riemann curvature tensor, you want to specify a Riemann curvature tensor, it's a good idea to do this in a Riemann normal coordinate system, because then this is the expression for the Riemann curvature tensor. It's simply the difference between these two derivatives there. Otherwise, you get this squared stuff and all that. Okay, so now we see how to calculate the Riemann curvature tensor from the Christoffel symbols. Super important, because remember, by defining the Christoffel symbols, we defined the affine connection. We defined parallel transport. And then we said, once we know how parallel transport works, we know that the spacetime has to be curved. How? Now we can calculate the curvature. So you give yourself the Christoffel symbols, and then you can calculate what the curvature tensor is. Now we only have to find out what the curvature tensor does. What does it physically mean? Now, first intuition is this. It contains derivatives of the Christoffel symbol. That's important because the Christoffel symbol encodes gravitational forces and pseudo forces. Derivatives of that are derivatives of gravitational forces. But what is a derivative of a gravitational force? It's a tidal force, right? Let's say you are too close to a black hole. Then the part of you that is closer to the black hole is being pulled stronger to the black hole than the part of you that is further away from the black hole. That may rip you apart. In fact, moons that get too close to their home planet can get ripped apart because of tidal forces. Because the part of the moon that is closest to its planet would have to have a different orbital frequency than the part of the moon that is further away from the planet. So there's always this tug-off war going on. It's also, by the way, the reason why the moon is always showing us the same side. See? Because if it rotated, which it did for many, many million years, it did rotate, it gets squeezed. It's not spherical because the different parts of the moon are exposed to different strength curvature from the Earth. So as the moon is orbiting the Earth, it is not a sphere, it is deformed. Now, if the moon was rotating, then that means it would be just like a piece of dough that you rotate and always put in the same form, but rotating, right? And that costs energy. It will heat up the moon, all right, but it will be at the expense of the rotational energy. And that's why moons often lock, gravitationally lock to their parent planet. Not all of them, but our moon does it, obviously. Anyway, how did we get to talk about the moon? Did you know that the mother of Neil Armstrong, the first person to work on the moon, had a maiden name, Moon? There you go. Anyway, intuition. So the Christoffel symbols contain derivatives. The Riemann curvature tensor contains derivatives of the Christoffel symbols, so tidal forces. That's what we should expect. All right, now, but geometrically, what is curvature geometrically? After all, even if there was no time involved, just for a space itself, it could have curvature, then there are no tidal forces. So what is curvature then? Well, curvature expresses the non-commutativity of two parallel transports. That is what it is. And remember, we motivated that earlier. I said, if you are on the North Pole and you point in some direction, you walk towards the equator, always parallel transporting your arm. You walk along the equator, always parallel transporting your arm. You walk up to the North Pole, always parallel transporting your arm. Your arm no longer points in the same direction as it did when you first started your trip. That's non-triviality of parallel transport. That's what curvature does. And here's the proposition, the so-called Ricci identity, that makes that very clear. So assume the torsion vanishes, otherwise curvature and torsion will mix each other up and it becomes intuitively very complicated. But let's assume that the torsion vanishes. And let's some vector field xi, let's take some tension vector field xi. Then the following is true. If you parallel transport your vector field xi in the direction of eta, just like for the torsion, right? In the direction of eta, while you carry the vector nu in your pocket and parallel transport it. So if you do this, if you parallel transport nu in the direction of eta, and you walk this way, and you parallel transport, of course, also your vector xi, or alternatively, you parallel transport along this way, the parallelogram, since there is no torsion by assumption, you end up at the same location. But the two vectors may not be pointing in the same direction. So the parallel transport of xi may not lead to the same vector this way around, or that way may not lead to the same vector. Or if you work this way parallel transporting and that way parallel transporting, since there's no torsion, you can now also take the path back upwards and downwards again. And then you can compare the starting vector psi to the ending vector psi. Now they live in the same vector space. And then you can find out that there is some deficiency vector in between them. It may be rotated. Now, parallel transport cannot change the length of a vector. So the only thing that can happen here is that this vector is rotated in that direction. But of course, that could be a hyperrotation, could be a Lorentz transformation. Okay, so it's the invariant length of the manifold that's being preserved in there. Okay, so what the Ricci theorem says is this. If you parallel transport your vector this way, or parallel transport it that way, then it's expressed in terms of the covariant derivative, two covariant derivatives. The semicolon with two indices means covariant derivative with respect to C and covariant derivative with respect to C, and or the other way around. This is given by that expression. And I skip the details, but all the details are in the lecture notes, just because we're running out of time. What you find is that the deficiency vector here, so the vector by which we rotated here by performing this parallel transport along the parallelogram, that vector's coefficients, the difference vector's coefficients, is given for a small parallelogram by the eta vector, the new vector, contracted with the Riemann curvature tensor, and then also contracted with xi. Let's look at the anatomy of this. Just like for the torsion, let's say, OK, we give ourselves an eta and a nu. So we define our parallelogram. Then we contract that, the eta and the nu, with the Riemann curvature tensor. And there the first two indices go, because they get contracted with the eta and the nu. Right? So they are gone at that point, because we've contracted that. We've made our choice of parallelogram by choosing the eta and the nu. Those two indices are already annihilated by contracting with this. Then we are left with one upper index and one lower index. That's a map. You see, if you have a tensor with an upper and a lower index, then you contract the lower index with a tangent vector, you get a tangent vector out of it. In fact, this matrix that you get with one upper and one lower index is a Lorentz transformation. It's a rotation. In fact, it's an infinitesimal rotation, right? Because we're just going an infinitesimal parallelogram. So actually, what we are left with is an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation that maps the xi vector into how much of a deficiency we get. So the Riemann curvature tensor eats up two of its covariant slots, where you have the opportunity to specify your parallelogram. And then the remainder is a rotation. And if for a Riemannian manifold, for a positive definite metric, this would be just an actual rotation. But for a Lorentzian manifold with some non-trivial signature, this would be a Lorentz transformation, infinitesimal one. OK. Now, how would we prove this? Well, we go through these calculations that we don't have time for, but I give you all the details, and I very much recommend that you go through this. In fact, because we don't cover it in the lecture explicitly, you can use it in your essay when you discuss ways to describe curvature or the shape of a manifold. Then, by all means, if you like, explain this in words. Don't just reproduce the equations, but maybe, if you like, you know, just fill in the explanations. In this way, you can demonstrate that you got it. OK. Right, so we can prove this. And then finally, let me just mention Bianchi identities. Let me just give you the gist of this. There are certain relations among the degrees of freedom of curvature and torsion that are trivially obeyed. It looks like there's some non-trivial stuff around, but actually there are equations that always hold. And by that I mean, even if you don't impose the Einstein equation, obviously we haven't covered it yet, you can already say something about the curvature. Because there is no way to avoid certain structural equations of general relativity. They're just differential geometry. Before you get to pick your laws of nature, mathematics already tells you that the curvature has this and this and that property. I mean, for example, if you look at the interpretation of the Riemann curvature tensor that we just had, remember we said that you get to pick your parallelogram and take the two vectors, contract them with the Riemann curvature tensor, and then you get the rotation, right? You get the rotation for the deficiency vector. Now imagine you picked your parallelogram in such a way that you choose two vectors that are actually parallel to each other. Well, then you shouldn't get anything, right? There shouldn't be any deficiency vector because your path going and your path going back is the same, right? How does it show up? Well, it shows up in that these two indices that you contract with when you specify your parallelogram are antisymmetric. The Riemann curvature tensor is antisymmetric with respect to these two indices. Remember which indices they are? It's Rij, and then you have AB. Right? These two indices, you have antisymmetry in this. Rij is minus Rji. That ensures that if you have a trivial parallelogram, then you don't get a rotation there. Anyways, there are certain identities that hold no matter what. They're just a property of mathematics, not of physics. And it's important to know about them. And some of the most important ones are the so-called Bianchi identities. As a little preparation, I have to tell you about how to generalize the covariant derivative that we now know how to apply to tensors to maps. How can we covariantly differentiate a map? And it's simple. We simply use the fact that maps, linear maps, and tensors are the same thing, really. Right? It's just a matter of interpretation between them. So what we do is we say, imagine you have a map, a FM linear map, which means that you can multiply with arbitrary functions. So it's linearity with respect to multiplying with functions, the usual thing for tensors. So let's say K is such a map. It takes a certain bunch of tangent vectors and maps them into, let's say, a tangent vector. This is the structure of the torsion map. This is the structure of the curvature map, right? Curvature map has three inputs. Torsion map has two inputs. But they both map a bunch of tangent vectors into a tangent vector. Then, at every point in the manifold, K has this structure. It maps R tangent vectors into a tangent vector. And we want to know how to covariantly differentiate K, a map. So far, we only know how to covariantly differentiate tensors. So now, how to covariantly differentiate a map? Well, we can view our map as a tensor that is R-fold covariant, so that you can feed it R tangent vectors, and the output will be a tangent vector. Right? So, and then that's the usual definition. The K tilde as a tensor, if you feed it in all of its slots, R tangent vectors, one cotangent vector, then it's the same as taking the map, feeding it with its n tangent, R tangent vectors, and then evaluating against the omega. OK, that's just what we had. And now we extend, we use this to the extended definition of covariant derivative from tensors to maps by saying that if you apply the covariant derivative to our map, OK, then it should evaluate the same as if you took the covariant derivative of the tensor and evaluated it with the argument. So we simply pull the definition of covariant derivative from tensors to maps. OK, so with this definition, we can covariantly differentiate maps. And with that, we can write down the so-called Bianchi identities. There are two of them. And they look like this. They look super complicated, but I have good news, which is that in nature, it seems torsion is not there, which means this term is not there, because it's full of torsion. And also, that term is not there, no torsion there. Right? So the good news is that actually the Bianchi identities that we will be dealing with in general relativity, given by this is equal to 0, and that is equal to 0. Big simplification, but keep in mind, that if you want to do quantum gravity, you may have to go back to this and remember that maybe there are fluctuations around torsion equal to zero, and then you may have to, you may find it useful to use these identities. So as I said, these equations hold always as a mathematical fact. There's no way to avoid them. It has nothing to do with the Einstein equations. There is a similar thing that you may know from quantum mechanics, or maybe not know. You see, you know the Jacobi identity, right? Do you know how that works? You may know that from Lie algebras, right? So you have commutator of AB with C plus commutator of C with A B plus commutator of B with C A equal to zero. In quantum mechanics, that's true for all operators. This could be XP, Hamiltonian, whatever you want. Always true. Of course, we always want this to be true also for Lie algebras, Jacobi identity, right? Now, for Lie algebras, that's non-trivial. It has to be specified. But for operators in Hilbert space, it is trivial. Why? Just write out what it is, right? This is going to be A, B minus B, A, C minus C, A, B minus B, A, plus blah, 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 blah. Just check it out. The whole thing becomes zero anyway, right? It's automatic. Whenever you have linear operators, they will obey the Jacobi identity, which is why in Lie algebra theory, we add the Jacobi identity as an axiom. Because a priori, these guys, the elements of the Lie algebra, are not necessarily linear operators. But we want them to be representable as such. So we need the structure of the Jacobi identity, because if they didn't obey the Jacobi identity, then they could do whatever they want, but they will not be representable as linear operators. Okay? Now, here we have these wild Bianchi identities. They look like nothing we've seen before, probably. And then I'm telling you that they have to be obeyed anyway. Let's look at the first one. Why would that thing hold? It turns out it holds because of this. It's exactly that. You can reformulate it in terms of exactly this. So here we have the Riemann curvature map acting on the nu. You may wonder, where did we need the covariant derivative of maps? Well, not here. Oh, no. Yes. Here we have a covariant derivative of a map. But if the tangent, if the torsion is vanishing, then that's gone. But here we have a covariant derivative of a map, the Riemann curvature map, right? Anyway, so if we just look at this equation with absent torsion, then we don't even have to covariantly differentiate maps. Then what do we have to do? Well, this is the first Bianchi identity. And remember, the curvature tensor is the commutator of the covariant derivatives minus the covariant derivative of the commutator plus cyclic permuted arguments. And then with a bit of gymnastics of just writing this stuff down, it turns out to be this. And then I leave it to you as a little exercise to prove this. By the way, keep that in mind. That's an important thing to know, that if there's no torsion, then this is true. Do you see already why that's true? It's because the torsion is, by definition, the difference between the commutator of the covariant derivatives and the commutator of the ordinary derivatives. And that is that difference, right? It's the commutator of the covariant derivatives minus, if you put that on the other side, the ordinary commutator of ordinary derivatives, because the eta and the nu are tangent vector fields, so they are derivatives. So if you put that on the other side, then you have here commutator of covariant derivatives minus commutator of ordinary derivatives. This is, by definition, the torsion. So if the torsion vanishes, then this commutator of covariant derivatives is the commutator of ordinary derivatives. It's a useful thing to use. And if we use that here, then the first Bianchi identity becomes this expression here, Again, I recommend that you go through the details, but I think it would be just tedious if we did that in detail here. We're also out of time. But then this expression here, because of that, you see, this structure is exactly that structure. Okay, this vector occurs here, xi, xi. That vector occurs there. It's a nu. This is just a commutator. So this is just this commutator here, plus cyclic. And now you see, this is that. And tangent vector fields are linear operators. Because what do? They differentiate a function. So they map function into function. And they map 5 times the function into 5 times the function. So the xi are linear operators, and therefore, yeah, sure, they obey this just by writing out what the commutator is. So in a way, this demystifies the Bianchi identities. Keep in mind, they are kind of mathematical trivialities, but it's useful because they're equations between quantities that occur all the time. And this, we will later see, translates also into symmetry, anti-symmetry properties of these indices of the Riemann curvature tensor then. But we will get to that later on. And here I'm just spelling out that this is the same as that thing over there. And I think, yeah, that's it for today. I'm sorry we went so much over time, but I told you about garages and things that I hadn't planned to talk about. I hope it made it more intuitive. Okay? See you on Tuesday. By the way, next week Friday, is that a holiday? No, it's not, right? There's going to be classes as always, right? Okay. So we have classes Tuesday and Friday. And then there is some kind of holiday week, right? Okay.